calculating the cost
of a big, fat Greek divorce.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Thursday, May 24th.
Coming up, the connection between your job and your vote.
How does the leader of the eighth largest economy in the world plan to balance the budget? We'll ask him.
Just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
It was an informal summit. European Union leaders met and everyone agreed they very much want Greece to stay within the European single currency, the euro. But it's clear there is some contingency planning going on in case there is a parting of ways. The BBC's Andrew Walker joins us from London. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, David.
Greece leaving the euro is being likened to, metaphorically, a divorce. How much would a divorce cost Europe?
That's enormously difficult to estimate in terms of the wider economic costs because you're dealing with unpredictable financial market investors and even more unpredictable, how would bank depositors in those countries respond? That enormous range of views is such that I think it's really difficult to put any kind of authoritative number on what the costs would be, although there's no doubt that at least in the short term, they would be very high. And there certainly are suggestions that the European Union and the International Monetary Fund would come up with some sort of transitional help. Figures have been suggested of the order of 50 billion euro as a kind of divorce settlement is the phrase sometimes used, although rather unusually for a divorce settlement. This is probably money that would have to be repaid.
And at some level, we're getting ahead of ourselves because there's still a Greek general election that has to happen.
Yes, indeed. And I think an awful lot of this talk is intended to put the pressure on Greek voters. We know that the overwhelming majority of the Greek population wants to stay in the euro, but they don't want the difficult austerity and economic reforms that are being demanded of them. The hope, at least in Europe, is that that will encourage them to vote for parties in Greece that will go ahead with those reforms that have already been agreed by the previous government.
The BBC's Andrew Walker in London. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Okay, so that's the view from Europe's debt crisis. Well, in Washington, an end-of-year fight over raising the federal debt ceiling is looking more likely because of partisan differences over spending and taxes. And here in California, the eighth-largest economy in the world, a $16 billion budget deficit has state leaders asking, what is a fair mix of cuts and taxes to close the gap?
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
As part of our coverage of wealth and poverty, California Governor Jerry Brown joins us now from Sacramento. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you've got a $16 billion budget hole right now. Your ability to raise taxes is limited because of voter-approved propositions in part. Your ability to cut spending is limited because of lawsuits. What are you going to do?
Well, we're going to cut and we're going to hopefully tax. The tax will be subject to voter approval this November. In terms of the cuts, I proposed some pretty drastic cuts in social services, Medi-Cal, which nationally is Medicaid, to the courts, a lot of very drastic cuts. So we have both a tax and a cut. It's very difficult to get a tax passed when you go to the electorate, but this is the kind of decision in a democracy I think the people are most well-equipped to ultimately make.
So you're not worried that if you raise taxes on the wealthy even further here in California that you're going to lose some of the innovators and entrepreneurs that are so many of them in this state?
Well, you know, if you look at the data, as you go up the income scale, the wealthier you are, the faster you're growing in the wealth that you're accumulating. And if you go to the people lower down the scale, making $40,000 or $30,000 or $50,000, some of them actually are losing ground. So it's only fair. This is the only tax that has any chance of passing. Were I not to do it, then we'd have to double the amount of cuts. I mean, the fact is, we're a wealthy state, and the public sector needs an amount more than it's now getting.
Now, let me ask you this, because you're going to ask the public to approve this tax increase.
Yes.
I have to say, when I talk to friends around the country, they look at the system in California and they say, why don't they just throw out this constitution that requires voters to approve everything that they do? They can't do anything with all this.
Well, that's an interesting turn of phrase. why don't we just throw out this constitution? They've done that in a number of countries. It's called the coup d'etat. Look, this is a democracy. You can find fault with it. But compared to the paralysis in Washington, at least we have an ultimate arbiter, which are the people themselves. You can't squeeze blood out of a turnip. We only have so much money, and they've been kicking the can down the road, gimmicks, accounting maneuvers. And at this stage of my life, I'm coming back after a 27-year hiatus here, and I'm going to make this budget balance, and I'd rather do it with taxes. If we don't have that, we'll do it the old-fashioned way with some pretty drastic cuts.
Let me ask you one last thing, Governor. When you want to get away from all this stuff up there in Sacramento, where do you go? What's your happy place in California?
Well, I live in Oakland. I find that extremely happy, if you want to call it that. It's a great place. We've got great parks and trails. I can see out into the Pacific 50 miles on a clear day. And I like to read about the decline of the Roman Empire. And then I like to read about all the successes that people were able, in the face of challenge, to overcome against terrific odds. And I think that through facing things with clarity and courage, we can get the job done. And maybe we can inspire some of the same spirit of resolve, both for Washington and maybe even in Europe.
California Governor Jerry Brown, thank you so much.
Okay.
There's news today that orders for long-lasting so-called durable goods rose less than expected in April, a scant 0.2%. Durable goods are things like airplanes, cars, even computers. Analysts have watched computer sales in the past for what they might tell us about economic growth. But as Marketplace's Bob Moon reports, PC sales may not be much of a bellwether anymore.
It's long been accepted that employers need to update their computers, especially when they're hiring. Frank Gillette is a tech analyst at Forrester Research.
Add new employees, generally you're going to buy a new computer for them.
Trouble is, now it's not so simple. Fierce competition has cut PC prices, and businesses could be taking advantage of that just to refresh their current technology needs. David Daoud is an analyst for IDC.
You don't really see companies hiring the type of workers that may need new technology, and therefore they're still focusing on low-end entry-level systems.
And Forrester's Gillette says the growing popularity of tablet computers is making things even more complicated. He says businesses are rethinking what kind of machines they buy.
There are significant numbers of people, salespeople, field service executives, who get up and move around a lot. And for them, a tablet may change the type of computer they seek to buy.
Gillette says that's made it important to watch both PC and tablet sales as an indicator of business growth, and tablet sales keep rising. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau announced this week it is trying to figure out how to regulate prepaid debit cards, basically reloadable visas more and more people are carrying around instead of cash. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from Washington.
You can get a prepaid card anywhere, online, at a store, and then you load it up with cash or a paycheck and swipe away at the gas station, at the ATM, at Amazon. But we all know there's a catch. Here's Michelle Jun of Consumers Union.
A company may say that you have free access to loading your funds, but you're going to have to pay up to $5 with a reload pack.
Some 13% of us use prepaid cards, and it's growing. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau fears the cards aren't backed by protections given regular credit card holders, say limits on fees from stores or caps on losses if your card is stolen. But of course, fees to you and me are revenue for the banks. Industry analyst Bert Ely.
If fees are restricted in one area or another, then banks have to earn that fee income elsewhere.
He says prepaid cards may not be a big profit maker, but banks are starting to offer them to bring in customers and introduce them to other products. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Officials in Houston are trying to figure out what to do with the Astrodome, renovate it or tear it down. The domed stadium was once called the eighth wonder of the world, but it hasn't hosted a sporting event or concert in years. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
As the baseball season gets underway, the spanking new Astrodome is the new $31 million home of the Houston Astros.
That was 1965. Today, it would cost $64 million just to tear it down. A consultant's report urges more than $250 million in local taxpayer spending to renovate the Astrodome, host trade shows and science exhibits. That could harken back to the early days.
A space-age sort of atmosphere at the ballpark. The ball girls dressed as astronauts.
Kevin Reichardt of BallparkDigest.com says other space-age domes soon followed: New Orleans, Tampa, Minneapolis. Nowadays, though, team owners want retractable roofs.
Baseball is a game where it's played in the prime of summer and people expect to have the sunshine on them and the grass growing and the smell of popcorn.
Seattle's King Dome couldn't offer that and fell to the wrecking ball. Reichardt thinks Detroit's Silver Dome could face the same fate. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Today, the New York Times is reporting that the main newspaper in New Orleans, the Times-Picayune, could be facing massive staff cuts and maybe even cut back on its daily printing schedule.
Here to talk with us in today's Marketplace Midday Extra is Jed Horn, who served as city editor at the paper during Hurricane Katrina. Good morning, Mr. Horn.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. The Times-Picayune won so many awards and praise and readers for its performance over the years, really, of course, but also during Hurricane Katrina. I remember reading the amazing coverage that you did online in the teeth of the storm. But how has this luster faded so quickly?
Well, I don't think the quality of the paper has faded all that quickly. The problem here is economic. The shift to the internet simply hasn't been met with a business plan that monetizes all those eyeballs in the way that print readership has been valuable to advertisers.
Bring us back to Katrina, just to give people a sense of how important this paper was, both in terms of the news that it was providing to the outside world during that event and also to the people who lived in New Orleans. And so I know that didn't you deliver the papers right to the convention center?
There was that, and there was also the ability, a challenge to say the least, to bring papers right into the centers of diaspora, as it was called, these refugee communities that sprang up in Atlanta and Baton Rouge and Houston and elsewhere. And we were greeted like angels descending. I mean, it was amazing to see people tear open that paper, those bundles, and appreciate the Times-Picayune for the lifeline that it really was and remains in this community.
What do you think we'll end up with here, at least in the medium term, a newspaper that gets published every few days or a smaller newspaper?
Well, I think that is the industry trend, the reduction actually in the number of days in the week that it's published. Mondays, you know, are lost leaders. The money lies in the weekend. The trend is definitely away from 7-day a week publication. There's apparently going to be this need to kind of move away from investigative work and analysis and just kind of blog madly to feed the beasts 24 hours a day. And that's a great concern to serious journalists.
Do you see any newspaper anywhere in the country that is doing something that would be a model that would work for the Times-Picayune? If you had the bosses of the paper on the phone right now, if you said to them, just do this and everything will be all right, is there any solution like that?
The New York Times, in three words. They seem to have made the transition to an intelligent web model for news delivery. The finances, you'll have to talk to the Times about that. I think they are making money off their website after a long period in which they had to invest in it without return. But they seem to have understood that an online newspaper still has to be at least reminiscent of a newspaper as we knew it, and not just because of dinosaurs like myself who are accustomed to the traditional model, but because it has its inherent logic and there's a good reason to display news in the more nuanced way that they've figured out, whereas I think some of the other websites are just, you know, kind of tab headlines thrown at readers in a helter-skelter way that's hard to figure out, hard to navigate, and it's a real problem. And I think that's partly why the advertising returns are so limited on the web.
The stakes are high here, though, right? I mean,
there are businesses
that could fail, and maybe society wouldn't lose much, but it's a little hard to run a democracy in New Orleans or any other place without a strong set of reporters covering public issues.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think there's a real peril, particularly in a city like New Orleans or in a state like Louisiana, famous for its corruption, the subversion of the public will by officials. There's a ceaseless need to be probing into those dark corners, and that's taken newspaper kind of resources, newspaper staffing levels, and the willingness, the ability to commit long-term to investigative projects and to explore areas that may not yield journalism, but that have to be probed anyway.
Jed Horn is former city editor of the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure.
Moving on now, how does what you do for a living shape who you're going to vote for in November?
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Let us do our weekly attitude check in association with Gallup and say good morning to Frank Newport, Gallup's editor-in-chief. Hello, Frank.
Good morning.
So you've been looking at this connection between how people vote and employment category. What'd you find?
Well, indeed we have. We aggregated together over 20,000 interviews we've done so far since mid-April, where we asked people who you're going to vote for. One thing we find is that one of Obama's great areas of strength is among professional workers. That would be lawyers, doctors, scientists, teachers, engineers, computer programmers. He's beating Romney by 8 points among the professional class. He also does well among service workers who tend to be unionized. He wins well there. But Romney has strength among managers and executive leaders of industry, people who tell us they're business managers or executives. He leads there by 7 points. And finally, David, I know you'd be interested in this. 2% of Americans say they're farmers or fishermen in that category, and they swing way for Romney. So Obama shouldn't waste much time trying to go after the farm vote, I don't think.
But it's interesting, just on this division, professionals, doctors, lawyers, dentists prefer Obama, and managers may prefer Romney. So it's not really a class argument. There's something about the type of work these people do that shapes their worldview.
Absolutely. Very good insight. When we look at education, one of the fascinating things in the data is it is postgraduates. That's the big dividing point. If you have a postgraduate degree, you swing significantly back in favor of Barack Obama. Now, that would be people who make higher incomes, so it's clearly not income, but people who have postgraduate degrees, and that would be lawyers to PhDs and MDs and what have you, tend to be more liberal in political orientation, and they're sympathetic to the Democratic candidate Barack Obama.
Now, you mentioned unionized workers, public employees, but what about unionized workers in general? Obama must have them in the bag.
Well, it depends on your definition of in the bag, but in our data, 55% of union members, which is a small group of Americans nowadays, 55% for Obama, 38% for Romney. So he clearly does well among union workers, but it's not monolithic, not 100% by any means.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of Gallup, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
People in northern Italy are still dealing with the aftermath of the earthquake the other day that killed 7. It struck hardest in some of Italy's richest farmland, and among the region's best-known products are two cheeses, Parmesan and Grana Padano. Those are big exports. The BBC's Alan Johnston has more now from Rome.
Parmesan is produced in big, round wheels, each weighing nearly 90 pounds. And to taste just right, they have to be stacked up and left for 2 years. But the earthquake brought mayhem, toppling huge stacks of cheese. Altogether, more than 400,000 wheels came crashing down. 10% of the world's supply of Parmesan has been affected. Leo Bertozzi is director of the Parmigiano Reggiano Cheese Consortium, which represents producers. He described the scene in one of the Parmesan warehouses.
There were shelves with thousands and thousands of wheels of cheese, all falling down one on another, like on a domino effect.
But despite the disruption, the Parmesan makers say that because they produce over 3 million cheese wheels a year, they don't anticipate a shortage. So that means there should be no price hikes for Parmesan lovers. In Rome, I'm the BBC's Alan Johnston for Marketplace.
The term is crowdsourcing, and by one definition, it means getting lots of people to do something for free instead of paying for a few people to do it. Today's example of crowdsourcing, a Singapore-based startup called Viki, V-I-K-I. It gets rights to TV shows, say a South Korean soap opera, and via the internet gets the world to contribute free subtitle translations. The company's founder says it's a way of liberating the 90% of content that gets trapped within borders. A Korean soap opera that was a flop in its home market was apparently topping the charts on Viki, where now Playful Kiss is subtitled in more than 50 languages.
And finally, David, to Trader Joe's, where there has been a run on chocolate chips. Apparently, the company that makes a popular brand of kosher chocolate chips changed the way it cleans its equipment, and now it can no longer say that the chips are dairy-free. As a result, Jews who keep kosher and love cookies race to Trader Joe's to stock up on the old packages. And the New York Post headline for this story was, Chips Ahoy Vey.
I am not worthy. My grandmother would have been so proud had I come up with that, but it was the Post, huh? Right.
They're very clever about that stuff. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update on APM, American Public Media.